Chapter 4, Life in the Secret Annex. Monday, August 9th, 1943. Dear Kitty, to continue the Secret Annex daily timetable, I shall now describe the evening meal. Mr. Van Dan begins. He is first to be served, takes a lot of everything if it is what he likes. Usually talks at the same time, always gives his opinion as the only one worth listening to, and once he has spoken, it is irrevocable. Because if anyone dares to question it, then he flares up at once. Oh, he can spit like a cat. I'd rather not argue, I can tell you. If you've once tried, you don't try again. He has the best opinion. He knows the most about everything. All right then, he has got brains, but self-satisfaction has reached a high grade with this gentleman. Madame, really, I should remain silent. Some days, especially if there is a bad mood coming on, you can't look at her face. On closer examination, she is the guilty one in all the arguments, not the subject. Oh no, everyone prefers to remain aloof over that. But one could perhaps call her the kindler. Stirring up trouble, that's fun. Mrs. Frank against Anne, Margot against Daddy doesn't go quite so easily. But now at table, Mrs. Van Dan doesn't go short, although she thinks so at times. The tiniest potatoes, the sweetest mouthful, the best of everything, picking over is her system. The others will get their turn, as long as I have the best. Then talking. Whether anyone is interested, whether they are listening or not, that doesn't seem to matter. I suppose she thinks everyone is interested in what Mrs. Van Dan says. Coquettish smiles, behaving as if one knew everything, giving everyone a bit of advice and encouragement, that's sure to make a good impression. But if you look longer, then the good soon wears off. 1. She's industrious. 2. Gay. 3. A coquette. And occasionally pretty. This is Petronella Van Dan. The third table companion. One doesn't hear much from him. Young Mr. Van Dan is very quiet and doesn't draw much attention to himself. As for appetite, a Danadian vessel, which is never full and after the heartiest meal, declares quite calmly that he could have eaten double. Number 4. Margot. Eats like a little mouse and doesn't talk at all. The only things that go down are vegetables and fruit. Spoiled is the Van Dan's judgment. Not enough fresh air and games, our opinion. Beside her, Mummy. Good appetite, very talkative. No one has the impression, as Mrs. Van Dan, this is the housewife. What is the difference? Well, Mrs. Van Dan does the cooking and Mummy washes up and polishes. Number 6 and 7. I won't say much about Daddy and me. The former is the most unassuming of all at table. He looks first to see if everyone else has something. He needs nothing himself, for the best things are for the children. He is the perfect example, and sitting beside him, the secret annex's bundle of nerves. Dr. Dussel. Helps himself, never looks up, eats and doesn't talk. And if one must talk, then for heaven's sake, let it be about food. You don't quarrel about it, you only brag. Enormous helpings go down and the word no is never heard, never when the food is good, and not often when it's bad. Trousers wrapping his chest, red coat, black bedroom slippers, and horn-rimmed spectacles. That is how one sees him at the little table, always working, alternated only by his afternoon nap, food, and his favorite spot, the lavatory. Number 9 isn't a member of the secret annex family, but rather a companion in the house and at table. Ellie has a healthy appetite, leaves nothing on her plate, and is not picky and choosy. She is easy to please, and that is just what gives us pleasure. Cheerful and good-tempered, willing and good-natured, these are her characteristics. Yours, Anne. Monday evening, November 8th, 1943. Dear Kitty, If you were to read my pile of letters one after another, you would certainly be struck by the many different moods in which they are written. It annoys me that I am so dependent on the atmosphere here, but I'm certainly not the only one. We all find it the same. If I read a book that impresses me, I have to take myself firmly in hand before I mix with other people. Otherwise, they would think my mind rather queer. At the moment, as you've probably noticed, I'm going through a spell of being depressed. I really couldn't tell you why it is, but I believe it's just because I'm a coward, and that's what I keep bumping up against. This evening, while Ellie was still here, there was a long, loud, penetrating ring at the door. I turned white at once, got a tummy ache and heart palpitations, all from fear. At night when I'm in bed, I see myself alone in a dungeon without Mummy and Daddy. Sometimes I wander by the roadside, or our secret annex is on fire, or they come and take us away at night. I see everything as if it is actually taking place, and this gives me the feeling that it may all happen to me very soon. Meep often says she envies us for possessing such tranquility here. That may be true, but she is not thinking about all our fears. I simply can't imagine that the world will ever be normal for us again. I do talk about after the war, but then it is only a castle in the air, something that will never really happen. If I think back to our old house, my girlfriends, the fun at school, it is just as if another person lived it all, not me. I see the eight of us with our secret annex as if we were a little piece of blue heaven surrounded by heavy black rain clouds. The round, clearly defined spot where we stand is still safe, but the clouds gather more closely about us, and the circle which separates us from the approaching danger closes more and more tightly. Now we are so surrounded by danger and darkness that we bump against each other as we search desperately for a means of escape. We all look down below, where people are fighting each other. We look above, where it is quiet and beautiful. And meanwhile, we are cut off by the great dark mass, which will not let us go upwards, but which stands before us as an impenetrable wall. It tries to crush us, but cannot do so yet. I can only cry and implore, oh, if only the black circle could recede and open the way for us. Yours, Anne. Thursday, January 6th, 1944. Dear Kitty, my longing to talk to someone became so intense that somehow or other I took it into my head to choose Peter. Sometimes, if I've been upstairs into Peter's room during the day, it always struck me as very snug. But because Peter is so retiring and would never turn anyone out who became a nuisance, I never dared stay long, because I was afraid he might think me a bore. I tried to think of an excuse to stay in his room and get him talking without it being too noticeable, and my chance came yesterday. Peter has a mania for crossword puzzles at the moment and hardly does anything else. I helped him with them, and we soon sat opposite each other at his little table, he on the chair and me on the divan. It gave me a queer feeling each time I looked into his deep blue eyes, and he sat there with that mysterious laugh playing round his lips. I was able to read his inward thoughts. I could see on his face that look of helplessness and uncertainty as to how to behave, and, at the same time, a trace of his sense of manhood. I noticed his shy manner, and it made me feel very gentle. I couldn't refrain from meeting those dark eyes again and again, and with my whole heart, I almost beseeched him. Oh, tell me, what is going on inside you? Oh, can't you look beyond this ridiculous chatter? But the evening passed and nothing happened, except that I told him about blushing, naturally not what I have written, but just so that he would become more sure of himself as he grew older. When I lay in bed and thought over the whole situation, I found it far from encouraging, and the idea that I should beg for Peter's patronage was simply repellent. One can do a lot to satisfy one's longings, which certainly sticks out in my case, for I have made up my mind to go and sit with Peter more often and to get him talking somehow or other. Whatever you do, don't think I'm in love with Peter. Not a bit of it. If the Van Dans had had a daughter instead of a son, I should have tried to make friends with her too. I woke at about 5 to 7 this morning and knew at once, quite positively, what I had dreamed. I sat on a chair and opposite me sat Peter, Vessel. We were looking together at a book of drawings by Mary Boss. The dream was so vivid that I can still partly remember the drawings. But that was not all the dream went on. Suddenly, Peter's eyes met mine, and I looked into those fine velvet brown eyes for a long time. Then Peter said very softly, "If I had only known, I would have come to you long before." I turned around brusquely because the emotion was too much for me, and after that, I felt a soft and, oh, such a cool, kind cheek against mine, and it felt so good, so good. I awoke at this point while I could still feel his cheek against mine and felt his brown eyes looking deep into my heart, so deep that there he read how much I had loved him and how much I still love him. Tears sprang into my eyes once more, and I was very sad that I had lost him again, but at the same time glad because it made me feel quite certain that Peter was still the chosen one. It is strange that I should often see such vivid images in my dreams here. First, I saw Grandma so clearly one night that I could even distinguish her thick, soft, wrinkled, velvety skin. Then Granny appeared as a guardian angel. Then followed Lise, who seemed to be a symbol to me of the sufferings of all my girlfriends and all Jews. When I pray for her, I pray for all Jews and all those in need. And now Peter. My darling Peter, never before have I had such a clear picture of him in my mind. I don't need a photo of him. I can see him before my eyes, and oh, so well. Yours, Anne.